apprenticing to wise folk to solve the woes of the world. Welcome to the Sacred Lab Podcast with your host, Ryan Dickinson.
This is part three of our Farming for Health series. Just going to go through some of the things that we covered. In part one, nature's desire, which is seeking to maximize information and minimize entropy. And the human ecological niches, which are agents of disturbance, agents of decomposition, seed distributors, keystone predators, and agents of pacing. In part two, we covered criteria for a regenerative farm. Cannot be built on the fertility from other biomes, honoring and cradling the ecological niche of each organism. Crop choices based on suitability of each organism to the specific context, not the other way around. Land has to move toward highest expression of information that a specific context can provide. So, in this part three, we're hoping to cover grasslands and forests from a syntropic perspective. What have you got on that?
Yeah, so I guess last week we spoke about a bit more about some of the macro perspective and some of the tenets for regenerative agriculture. And yeah, it's quite a subjective and personal viewpoint. And I feel like a lot of the tenets that we spoke about, that was the fourth one, which was that it allows the human to return to the web of relationships. And I think a little bit I feel that that, with working with the other tenants, that brings us into that communication with the ecosystem, and particularly allowing all of the organisms and the land itself to participate in a sacred expression of life, which is where a lot of farms fall short, and it's informed by a lack of trust in ecosystems and doubling down on the mechanisms of control and ownership and the corruption that can occur through that modality. And yes, based on those four tenets, we have a few different agricultural modalities. There are some modern philosophies which are seeking to embody those tenets in a holistic manner, and most of the modern philosophies are really based on observations of both indigenous practices from around the world and also a keener appreciation for how nature operates and functions without human influence, and then realizing the ways that humans can intertwine themselves into that tapestry and improve the fecundity and the vitality of landscapes. And yeah, the modality that I have chosen to explore is syntropic agroforestry, and yeah, I think there is already some delineation within syntropic agroforestry away from those tenets, and yeah, I think it's quite important to kind of state that there is like a purist, I wouldn't say it's a dogmatic expression of syntropic agroforestry, which sort of stems from the founder and creator of the modality. And there are many ways in which some of the principles are being applied, and some of them are being applied through a more conventional lens and a more commercial industrial farming paradigm.
Right, so trying to use some of those syntropic methods applying to standard farms, and like, how can we make these more commercially viable without changing the fundamentals of how they're farming?
Yeah, and there's another expression which is coming forward, which is called successional agroforestry. And when we get more into the nitty-gritty of syntropic in the future, we'll be talking about succession, which is basically the natural evolution of complexity within an ecosystem. It's how, after a primary disturbance event, so like a massive fire or a big volcanic eruption, it's the process which nature, from that entropic event, reorganizes and starts to reform the web of relationships, and from lichens which move into that lava rock and start to break down the material within and create soil, and grasses move in and more complex grasses and herbaceous perennials start to move in, and woody weeds and shrubs, and they're all sort of laying the groundwork for the next generation of complexity, all the way up to a climax forest ecosystem, which is one of the driving forces of the syntropic philosophy. And that particular facility, that particular natural process, is employed within syntropic agroforestry. And there are now iterations of agroforestry which still harness and mobilize succession, but they also use inputs. And in doing so, a new term is being created, which is successional agroforestry, which is still working within the philosophy, but it's making use of waste material from surrounding landscapes and within our current transition from conventional into more regenerative ways of thinking. That is still a prominently available resource and tool to create extra fertility and to move ecosystems forward. But within a more commercial level of syntropic agroforestry, efficiency is important, and having a sort of more of a singular mindset for a target species. Not to say that it's the only species, but a lot of large-scale, broad-acre syntropic farmers will really target one species, whether it's cacao or banana or coffee, and they will set up the forest with the idea of the organisms within it that are expressing succession and biodiversity, that their focus is on supplying the needs specifically for the coffee plant, as an example.
Okay.
And in doing so, on a large scale, like hundreds of acres, the efficiency of management sometimes requires a delineation from a purely regenerative or a purely syntropic outlook, and that might mean employing machinery. It might mean a severe reduction in biodiversity. So rather than having 300 different species in a forest, that might be reduced down to 7 key species, which are easy and efficient to manage, are easy to prune and work around the needs of the coffee plant, are easy to cut back at harvest time to create extra access. And a lot of those things make it more commercially viable within the modern lens, but open up these systems to a bit of vulnerability. The machinery creates compaction, the lack of biodiversity creates a lack of resilience at times. If one of those 7 species succumbs to a pest problem or a fungal issue or something, then the web of relationships is weakened, and the more species that you have, the denser that matrix within that web of relationships becomes, and the more resilient, the more contingencies and redundancies are created. So maybe we're getting a bit off tangent in terms of context, but yeah, it's important to note that even within syntropic, there are different applications, and there are factions that are being created, and there are people that are trying to move the philosophy more into a subsistence farming kind of personal systems or small community-based systems.
Prioritizing staple familiar crops and things like that.
And then there are other farmers that are working within the kind of conventional framework, and are still working large areas of land and are still working within the supply chain and all of the subsidiary networks that support modern farming and allow it to be distributed at much greater lengths within the nation or internationally. And within working in that framework, they are limited by the limitations that those frameworks create. And a lot of those are processing foods on an industrial scale. It's quite an upfront cost to develop many of the processing methods, and it's unaffordable to have multiple processing and distribution networks to a singular syntropic farm. And I guess because of that lack of biodiversity, the temptation to source extra nutrients, to move away from only finding the inputs within the context itself, but the other tenets of supporting organisms which are suitable to the context is very much upheld. Supporting the greatest expression of life is questionable. And sometimes in supporting the greatest expression of life, there is a difficult question which comes as to when the forest is mature enough, when it starts to move into that climax phase, its ability to produce, especially when you have canopy in an industrial sort of expression of syntropic, there is a point in succession where you either need to reset the system to zero and start again, or in a way offer it as a gift to the land and sort of move away from production. So there are different ways of operating in that lens, and you could definitely adopt a nativist approach where the target goal is to farm the forest for 20 or 30 years and to plant climax natively appropriate species, and then to essentially shift the system from a productive human ecology into more of a native forest system, and to kind of continue to manage it to that end rather than to a human end.
Okay, so why is that? Why would a climax forest, like, does it stop being productive? Or are, like, climax species not necessarily food crop species?
Yeah, both. And, there's a little bit of a paradox that occurs, that once the forest fully climaxes, which naturally could take 500 or 1,000 years, it ends up divesting in biodiversity in many ways. It becomes a red cedar climax, and the red cedar will, in Australia as an example, that red cedar will then occupy, you know, up to 70% of the biodiversity, and it's a lot of the climax species like yew and Californian redwood. They have non-edible resources that they can provide, especially timber. It becomes an incredibly fungal ecosystem, and a lot of the fauna finds it difficult to find foods in those habitats. It's almost like you can imagine an alpine setting. It's so dominated by pine, and there are only a number of species that can exist within the soil profile of a pine forest, and the need for biodiversity lessens. It's still resilient. And in the case of Ernst Gösch, he was inspired by the native peoples of Brazil, and he witnessed them traveling through the forest in almost a nomadic fashion, and they would find pockets of the rainforest that weren't expressing the fullest vitality, that weren't operating in that lens of maximum complexity. They would identify areas like an acre, and they will bring down the forest, and they will farm with annuals. So they're really embodying using annuals as a regenerative tool rather than holding the complexity to that level, to the level that supports annuals. They'll farm their annuals there for a year or two. They'll start to plant the tree seeds, and they'll start to support the natural regeneration of the forest. And once it becomes unproductive, they'll move to another location, and they'll fell that area, and they'll sort of move through these cycles of moving through the forest and identifying pockets and then farming them. And Ernst is quite inspired by that, and he himself identifies pockets of his own incredibly rich ecosystem, and he'll find areas where mistakes are made, in inverted commas, where he hasn't quite nailed the succession and the layering, the stratification of the plants. The complexity isn't quite as vibrant. There are pest issues in that one area, and he will bring those down. He won't bring down his entire forest, but he'll selectively choose pockets to reset and start again,
okay,
and work through succession and work through those target crops. And he could perpetually do that forever. He's already in his 70s, but whoever takes on the project after he leaves could essentially keep moving within a mindset of human production and commercial productivity, whilst supporting areas moving into that higher climax level of ecosystem.
Okay, so it's a kind of crop rotation, but it's like within the forest environment, rather than sort of clear felling a farm.
Mm.
You have your forest, and you have like, okay, this area is not doing well, so we can farm here for a couple of years.
Mm.
We can get our annuals, we can have our staples, and then once that starts to complexify beyond where we can utilize the crop species, we'll then identify another pocket and go there.
Yeah.
And then you let that original plot kind of come back, move over here. But you're kind of doing that throughout a forest.
Yes. And another thing to note about the viability and resilience of syntropic agroforestry is that if there is a devastating, extenuating situation like a drought, the forest floor is filled with fertility, and if farmers are struggling to farm annuals in a conventional setting or in a regenerative setting, the syntropic agroforester has the contingency, it has the redundancy to pull down the system and make a buck from farming annuals within some of their tree rows, because they have that living soil carbon mass and the adequate levels of moisture to supply high photosynthesis levels. There are different adaptabilities that syntropic agroforestry can offer a farmer in different extenuating circumstances that can provide extra sources of income when the rest of the landscape around them is not able or viable to do so.
Okay. So yeah. It's, you know, that quote of the difference between medicine and poison is dose.
Mm.
It's kind of disturbance is medicine, but at too great an extent, you deplete the system's ability to restore itself or to maintain the surplus of energy and moisture and life in the soil, and then it becomes an entropic system.
Yes.
It's kind of the dose of disturbance is what allows it to maintain that complexity of life.
Yeah, and I mean, we'll talk about disturbance later, and maybe I can share, just it's really relevant to that point. There's a I don't know if he was a botanist or a biologist. His name was Joseph Connell. He's an American man in the 70s who developed something called the IDH, which is the Intermediate Disturbance Hypothesis. And it's still a hypothesis, and there's a lot of validity to this particular thought, but he essentially put forward the idea that there is a Goldilocks zone between no disturbance and too much disturbance. And with no disturbance, we find species that are surrounding this property that we're on now. We find things like blackberry and lantana and camphor laurel and a whole range of species, many of which are identified as invasive pests. And those species are really capable of surviving and thriving with really low levels of disturbance. Nature wants to maximize information and minimize entropy, and if there are not adequate levels of disturbance occurring, it will mobilize species that are really capable of thriving without disturbance. And as we have lost the sentiment of disturbance, as people in Australia and in many places in the world, we have this hands-off approach to a lot of the ecosystems and national parks and things like this, a lot of the edge habitats around them become overwhelmed with invasives, with lantana, and they're kind of holding the fort, waiting for the disturbance, and they're building fertility. Like, lantana is starting to be considered one of the most miraculous soil builders, because it can thrive without disturbance, it can maximize photosynthesis, it can maximize the production of soil fertility without disturbance, and the soils found beneath them are so rich, the humus is amazing, and a lot of regenerative tree planters are engaging in finding pockets of lantana and planting bunya nut seeds, for instance. Like, it's a context that is suitable for reintroducing certain species. From a bush regen perspective, I have a friend who works quite intimately in bush regen. He has done for many years. One of the major goals is to support repopulating ecosystems with small native fauna, particularly birds. And they spend a lot of their time cutting and removing lantana. And
which
within
is a really
that,
good habitat for small birds.
Exactly. So that's one end of the intermediate disturbance hypothesis. At the other end, you find ecocide, essentially. You find overly high levels of disturbance, and that leads to a breakdown in complexity. It leads to a breakdown in the web of relationships, and you start getting different kinds of invasives that become really tenacious and are really the last line of defense before desertification. And these are also detestable species. Crown of thorns is a great example. It is just loaded with defense mechanisms. It has a ginormous taproot. It is holding its place in the soil. It is trying its best to stop the continued abundance of disturbance. And in the middle there, you have this Goldilocks zone, where you offer the disturbance to those species that can really thrive without it. You open up the canopy, you open up the ecosystem, which has a range of benefits. It introduces extra sunlight, it encourages germination of different seeds. You bring light into more of the flora, more of the web of relationships receives what it needs, and in response, all of those species are offered the option and the availability to thrive and to move through succession. So disturbance is a big tool for succession, which is difficult to grapple because we like to occupy a linear mindset that it's just one year after the other, things get better and better and better. Succession doesn't really operate within a linear frame, and disturbance, while it appears that we are removing information and complexity, ecosystems really rebound with a level of vigor that is not found with a lack of disturbance or with too much disturbance. And we'll get into that in a bit. Getting back in towards context, I think it's really important to state, and it should have been stated at the outset, that syntropic agroforestry is one answer. It's not the answer. And I think that we have a habit of taking a side or a team.
Yeah, we want the mono solution.
Yeah. And it's not viable in every location, as much as I would like it to be. The context is often dictating whether or not it is capable of supporting a forest.
Okay.
So I'm not holding on to this idea that it's the solution and creating dogma around that. There are a lot of other really viable and beautiful philosophies, and some of them are agroforestry philosophies and some of them are grassland philosophies. And within syntropic agroforestry, there are certain contexts that really it becomes a marvelous solution to help reduce inputs to help cradle organisms within their ecological niche, to help facilitate the highest level of expression of complexity in an ecosystem, to help create that landing space for humans to re-enter the web of relationships. And I feel like if it's done within its context in tropic agroforestry, particularly from a purist perspective, really offers all of those things. It is a management-based agriculture, not an input-based.
Okay.
So, and it involves the facilitation of complexity. It involves, it's from a purist lens, from Ernst and a lot of his acolytes, it becomes more about dropping the hierarchy. It involves, Ernst will describe himself as an endobiont. He is an organism living within another organism. He is just an individual performing its ecological niche. He's not a steward. He's not the manager. He's not the boss. He's not the dictating presence within the landscape. He is just managing within his capacity as a human, within operating within the ecological niches that we spoke about before, and he's just an organism within the macro organism, rather than the kind of overlord.
Mm.
And there are inputs, but it's a little bit different to the conventional setting of inputs. The major inputs are seeds, and human brain and human brawn. Yeah, so it's not requiring the investment of other biomes apart from seed. And seeds move naturally through the landscape, and humans can collect them and deposit them elsewhere. And in a way, I believe that is facilitating the base desire of procreation of species. There's an amazing guy that I love, Akiva Silva, and he talks about how you can take the seed from a tree, you can take the fruits, you can take the nuts, and you can give it a hug and you can thank it. But he believes that in many ways the tree is thanking you, because you are providing the dispersal for increasing the progeny to a wider realm, and it becomes facilitating and honoring its desires, which most life on Earth share the same desires as procreation. It's an underlying driving force, and for that reason it can be quite difficult for a syntropic agroforester to be classified as organic, because a lot of the seeds are wild foraged. There's no paperwork. There's not that arbitrary level of accountability that is found within organic farming. The record keeping, it's very difficult to demonstrate that the seeds that you are harvesting are coming, even if you're completely aware that there's no non-organic material in the area. As the only input is seed, it's very difficult to demonstrate the lineage of those seeds and to work it within the framework of organic. As with a few different kinds of organic farming, it's becoming more difficult to work within that framework, within that particular dogma. And it's one of the challenges, I guess, to receive that accreditation.
Right.
So there's a lot of farmers that are kind of just dropping it and ignoring it, and I won't get into it today, but
sure,
there are some holes within the organic mindset.
It doesn't seem to really go far enough with its stepping away from standard farming practices. It's, you know, it's still input heavy. It's, you know, still working with those same crops. There's no, succession to it. It's relatively conventional. They're just not using pesticides.
Yeah, and with an extra burden on bureaucracy that conventional farmers don't face, and for the small scale individual, the level of paperwork, the level of office work, that burden takes them away from the field, and it costs more to become accredited, and it creates this runoff effect where they have to pass that cost on to the consumer, and ultimately it spills out. Whereas within a centropic lens, there is no burden of input. So you're not having to pay. If you don't use machinery, there's no diesel. If you don't use pesticides and sprays, there's no poison expenses. If you're not using fertilizer, which from a pure centropic lens, it's the worst case scenario anyway, you have no input costs. It's just brain and brawn and seeds. Mm. And for that reason, if you can really work yourself into those natural processes and really execute in such a way, the burden of inputs is non-existent. And there are a lot of centropic farmers who are farming without inputs, and they are farming quietly without sharing that they're not using inputs, and they can come into the market at the level of a conventional farmer. But the conventional farmer has the input costs. So there are ways that you can kind of dance into this modern infrastructure of food supply without any costs, and you can come in at the lowest point and still be considerably more profitable than a conventional farmer, and still be more profitable to the fertility and the fecundity of the land as well, because a lot of those inputs are detrimental to the livelihood of soil microbes and the complexity on the land. So that's a really interesting kind of shift which is occurring, and because the cost of inputs are rising so steadily in every regard, whether it's glyphosate, whether it's diesel, whether it's fertilizer, the continued detriment to the ecosystems where those inputs are coming from, all of these costs are building, and a lot of conventional farmers are seeing their very paper-thin profit margin depleting. And there are some smiling regenerative farmers sort of waiting in the wings, and they have set up themselves so that they don't have to rely upon any externalities. The only thing they have to really worry about is processing and distribution, which is still involving diesel. It still involves inputs in the supply chain, but the actual production is becoming a lot more commercially viable. And I would also say that a lot of farmers, whether they're spiritual or whether they have a practice or an acknowledgement or an honoring, they love their land, and the proof is in the pudding. They can see the slow degradation of their land, and they're starting to think a bit more widely, and they're starting to leave the philosophies of their fathers and forefathers who informed the practice. And there is quite an encouraging and inspiring shift from conventional to regenerative, not because of the environmental benefits as much as the ballooning costs of farming. And I'll say it again, we are a reflection of the ecosystems that we live in. A lot of the farmers are living on incredibly degraded land, and their internal, their mind, their emotion, the hardship of farming, toiling the land, is having an effect. The younger generation is not coming through because they have an intuitive sense that it's wrong. And I don't like to use that word lightly, but there's a feeling that it's not working. And then there's the deplorable and sad instance of suicide within farming, and I feel like a lot of that is just reflective of the degradation that we're seeing in a lot of agricultural lands. And to bring it all back to grasslands and forests, those are the two agroecological biomes that we mostly operate in. There are other biomes, But a lot of farmers are operating, they're operating a grassland ecosystem in an area that is totally capable of supporting forests. Mm. And there's an expression that I like to use, which is the land wants a forest and the farmer wants a grassland. And that dissonance is creating an uphill battle immediately. It's not working within the context. It's not facilitating the highest expression of complexity. And in doing so, nature wants to move in that direction, and the farmer wants to move in another direction. And nature is quite cunning and will send agents to slow the process for the farmer, to make it more difficult. So whether it's tangible or whether it's a subconscious acknowledgement, or whether the backbreaking labor is becoming more backbreaking, there are these levels of impetus which are slowly but surely moving the conventional framework away from a lot of these practices, which are, I mean, they definitely don't fit in with the tenets of regenerative agriculture, but it's not quite working any longer. It's creating a sadness within country, and it's creating a sadness within the occupiers of those country, of the areas that they work on. And there's this slow entropic feeling which is encircling a lot of these rural townships, and the breakdown of the natural community is reflected in the breakdown of the human communities in these areas as well.
Mm. So in the I imagine that not all grasslands are tending toward forests.
100%. Yeah.
So is there a syntropic practice for grasslands?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure there are many people who would be working with different modalities. The one that I'm most aware of is holistic management, the Alan Savory method.
Okay.
Working
with ruminants and...
Yes. And there's the three keystone species within that philosophy in a reductionistic sense, but the first is the pasture, which becomes a keystone species. And as grasslands are bacterially dominant rather than fungally dominant, that bacteria is a keystone species. It's helping to not only break down the organic matter during the off-season and during periods of disturbance, but it's also facilitating the growth of the organic material. The soil is part of a cycle. The ruminants are the agents of disturbance, so they are playing the role of the human in an agroforestry setting. They are playing that same role in the grassland setting. They are creating that Goldilocks zone where they are providing adequate disturbance but not too much, and that's part of the holistic mindset. It's about creating this really intensive, organized plan of moving the ruminants around and creating the highest expression of complexity in doing so. And then I would say that we become the keystone predator,
right,
in a pleasant sense, but we become the driving force, that we're the predator at the back of the herd
that keeps the herd moving so that they're not devouring entire sections and then just being moved to another spot. They kind of
exactly.
They graze a little bit as they go, they shit a bit, they turn the soil up, but they keep moving through the
areas. Yeah, and we are harvesting their resource, which is just an innate part of it. There are holistic management that's more focused on dairy, but yeah, for a big part of it is about the production of incredibly high quality meats, which are also lovingly treated. They are held within their ecological niche, and in a way, a lot of holistic management practitioners, what they'll find is that the cattle will be waiting at the gate and they just have to open the gate. There's no mustering or rounding up. The cattle are so intimately cradled within their niche, and they're so aware that abundance is coming at 3 o'clock every day that they'll wait at the gate and they'll move on to that next level of pasture. And it's not, they're not enslaved. There's an expression of joy because they have everything they need. They aren't succumbing to more violent forms of predation very frequently, and they're allowed to operate, and whether they're conscious or unconscious, they are supplying that pivotal disturbance requirement for the pasture to thrive. And in doing so, the pasture is also thriving and offering more thrivability to the cattle itself. And I would say the other thing, and it relates to why certain ecosystems express grassland and forests, but typically a grassland has very low amounts of summer rain, and the moisture drops, and the cattle plays another role, which is supporting the continuation of the bacteria species, and they do so by cradling them within their rumen. So within those hot summer conditions that provide a little bit more challenge for the bacteria to proliferate and survive, a lot of those bacteria colonies are then held within the rumen, and they are cradled from the more challenging period of the year, and then they are pooed out into the grass, and the cattle is also protecting. They are a keystone protector of the biome in many ways as well. So they play an intimate role in many senses, just beyond disturbance and beyond the beautiful process of decomposition, like processing cellulose into manure and that fertility that arises, and converting inedible cellulose into meat. There's an alchemical process there, which makes those grassland ecosystems incredibly productive, I would say. And there is a little bit of contention within the Australian context. There's no hooved animals within the botanical history. And that is a really interesting debate. I don't know if I can particularly offer an answer, but I would say that the ecosystem of Australia is wanting to move to the highest expression of information and the lowest expression of entropy. And I think that the evidence suggests that ruminants can offer a higher expression of information, but it can't necessarily offer the same conditions of a lower expression of information within which form the context for a lot of the native species. A lot of the yam daisies and some of those things that we are protecting, they may or may not have arisen within a lower context of information. The Australian continent missed out on the Ice Age previously. It didn't get that same level of reset and disturbance that most of the planet got during the Ice Age, and it's kind of has lacked the same opportunities to express itself with the maximum amount of information. So there's a real dissonance in my heart of like protecting ecosystems, protecting in a conservational manner the ecosystems which I hold so dearly to myself, but I also wonder if via protecting them we are also disempowering nature from expressing the highest amount of information. We are disempowering it from it moving and becoming resilient. It's an abstraction that we're applying to the land that we should reverse the ecology to reverse the information back to a previous point, and whether that's through our own colonial guilt and shame, whatever it happens to be, whether it's because we believe that there are medicines that and resources and things that we can exploit from the native ecology, which is what I see a lot within the debate. It's incredibly egotistical to suggest that we know where nature is moving towards, what the result of invasive species will actually create on this continent, what 200, 400, 10,000 years in the future will look like. And through removing complexity, we aren't treating the ecosystem as a community. We're focusing on these individual nefarious agents rather than viewing them as organisms which have their own sacredness and are only there because they want to maximize the creation of information. So, and this creates a lot of dissonance within me. I don't know where to fall. I want to protect. I have a conservative viewpoint on natural ecosystems, but I also wonder at what cost, and if the answer is to remove information, we are removing resilience, we are removing the density of the web of relationships, we are making it more vulnerable and less capable of adapting to the wider macro climactic trends which are informing the world as we speak. It will have less contingencies and redundancies. The previous ecosystem evolved for a certain context, and we're moving into another context, and whether they are in alignment is a question that I don't have the answer to. I struggle with this concept. I struggle with this debate, and it's a ferocious, very emotional debate which is going on throughout the Australian continent right now. I don't know if the cane toad is actually going to lead to a higher expression of life in the long, long, long term. Mm. And if a natural part of the process is species decline, if that's okay within a wider viewpoint. And I'm of the position that, and this comes back to Dr. Zach Bush again, it's through his mindset, the biggest agent of the extinction crisis is agricultural chemicals, which are now pervading into all the waterways, they're pervading into our rain clouds, they're pervading into all of the ecosystems. They are agents of anti-life, antibiotics, and there are other things which I think are potentially more pressing than preventing species from executing their ecological niche, i.e. invasive weeds. I think that there's potentially a more insidious and more shameful element to the human interaction with the land, which is the use of certain chemicals which have a really deleterious impact on the ecosystems.
It was something I heard the other day listening to one of Ant Scotia's students, I can't remember his name, but he's talking about how on Ernst's plot of land, he introduced quite a few species there that wouldn't have otherwise gotten there other than in his hand. But there are species spontaneously emerging that were considered extinct.
Yes.
And so there's that thing of, while in the short term it may look, like you've got a concentration of European or Mediterranean species or whatever it might be, but in the long run, you're facilitating the ability for the seed bank to restore itself in these highly disturbed places. You know, another example is, I think I mentioned it on the first part of the Ian and Diane Haggerty over in Western Australia, and they started dredging their seeds in compost tea and putting those on the fields, and they noticed that in the same row as their pasture crop was coming up, a bunch of extinct grasses were also coming back. So it seems like it's the priority of removing poisons and toxins and unnecessary inputs and concentrating on increasing the complexity of life within the soil, that itself would tend toward seemingly the best of both worlds. It would facilitate the revival of these supposedly extinct species with the seed bank, you know, ideally being intact in whatever area, as well as, you know, there being these familiar crops that the current human occupants, you know, that's their source of food or whatever it might be. Yeah, for me, it makes sense to prioritize that complexifying of the information within the soil and of having that be as rich and full of life as possible, and not worrying so much about the purist perspective of like, well, was this plant in this, you know, in this ecology 200 years ago, da 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 da. Yeah, I think soil health is probably much more important than you know, having those favored plants kind of come back. Because yeah, like a lot of the time, like say in conventional conservation within Victoria and elsewhere in Australia, they're typically not working with seeds. And they have to continually give inputs to these areas that they're attempting to restore to what they understand to be how the land was 150, 200 years ago. And typically speaking, those areas, they don't establish a capacity to do that without the inputs. They haven't come up, you know, they haven't emerged in the newly conditioned soils. They're typically a seedling or even a more mature plant and put in the ground, and then, you know, it's palliative care for the rest of that organism's life. And so I think, yeah, abandoning some of that, you know, these are the plants that were here and they need to be here. I think the priority of they will come back if the seed bank is intact and if the soil is conditioned in the right way, but prioritizing the conditioning of the soil over here with these very active and successful plants that we have readily available, you know, likely your friends will come eventually.
Yeah, well, it's not working with the understanding of the necessity for disturbance, and it's not necessarily working with the understanding of succession either. And there, within the syntropic perspective, there's a partnering with invasive species. There's an understanding of their capacity to build soil fertility incredibly quickly, but there is also an adopted mandate that the progeny of those species will not go on unchecked, and it won't infiltrate the rest of the surrounding ecosystems. So there's a very strong awareness of the wider narrative of the conservation ideals within the country. But there's also an idea of, imagine if your garden was as voracious and vital as the weeds that are growing in it. Mm. Well, it can be, because those weeds can, they can be mobilized and they can be fed into the soil. Their ability to produce exudates and to build that soil complexity is unrivaled by a lot of our productive species. So in a way, we could adopt a different modality, which is of disturbance and correct understanding of disturbance, of removing senescence, of bringing down and decomposing fallen trees and feeding them back into the soil in a natural way, and then using seed, facilitating our ecological niche of spreading seed. And the land will determine the seeds that it's ready to hold. Mm. And it will express the seeds based on the complexity that's available. There are a lot of afforestation projects. There's reforestation, which is more expanding the forest out from the forest edge, and then there's afforestation, and you see all these amazing, inspiring videos of the guy with all the trees in, on his back, and he's planting them. That's afforestation. That's like, become a forest now,
right?
Rather than, let's work with natural processes, let's understand how things occur. And so many of those trees end up dying because the land is simply not equipped, the succession hasn't occurred. Mm. There are so many within bush regen and within afforestation around the world, so many of those ecosystems decline. There's very little biodiversity. They haven't offered the context. So working with context. Mm. And their afforestation is within a grassland. And a grassland is a bacterial dominant system. Yeah. It's not equipped to support the forest at that point unless we start to work within our ecological niche and start to facilitate those natural processes to the point. And this, I think the same goes with bush regen. It's about forcing a concept. Yeah. Be this complex now.
Mm.
And so many of them suffer and die because they're just simply outside of their ecological niche. They haven't been cradled. They haven't been allowed to express themselves. There is no choice of the land. A seed is a choice. It's empowering the land to make a decision, to understand that this seed can facilitate this role, and that the ecosystem can facilitate and cradle that species so that it can express itself and offer the complexity in return. There's this communally deterministic process which occurs, which is completely overlooked when we plant a seedling, which is, that's more of the human dominion, more of the, I want you to do this now, and you better do it, and I'll keep offering you these inputs, the palliative care approach to plants, rather than selectively choosing. And we could feed a lot of the invasives. We could feed that to the soil and to support a lot of the processes of occurring, which will then lead. And it brings us away from occupying the war room. We have this real militant approach to nature where we are constantly fighting and we're choosing these just despicable species as our enemy, and we're waging war. And I'm not quite sure if that is the modality for success, to continuously fight. We can occupy the mindset of an act of understanding is an act of peace, and that if we understand what those species are trying to accommodate in the ecology and help facilitate that role, they will move out on their own accord. Their niche will no longer be there. They won't want to be there, because the ecosystem has complexified to a point where it's no longer necessary for that species. It doesn't require its help. And this is what we see a lot in syntropic agroforestry. As we move through succession, some of the early pioneer species start to wither and fade because they have fulfilled their job. Mm. And going back to, when is it appropriate to bring down the forest? When is it appropriate to remove a species? Another ecological niche of ours is this discernment, is acknowledging and understanding the ecological roles of a lot of the species and bringing them down when it's clear that they're no longer thriving. It's clear that their role is complete, that the ecosystem is thank them, thank you so much for your job. You're no longer required. I've got it now. I've got another generation. I've got new agents who are more capable than you are, and the complexity is moving. It's quite interesting. And with those invasive species, when we disturb them at a particular point in their sigma growth curve, which is as they're entering flowering, is the optimal opportunity to cut and remove them.
Okay.
And in doing so, we prevent their progeny, we prevent their proliferation, and we maximize their capacity to add fertility and information. And we're working with species that are incredible and that thrive. We are peacefully engaging with them to help facilitate the highest expression of complexity, which is a fundamental element of the syntropic philosophy. And often species are chosen not in regards to whether they're invasive or not, but how equipped they are to perform a role really well, with the understanding and the responsibility and the mandate that they will then cease to spread into the other areas unchecked. But it's interesting to see how that syntropic philosophy can apply to many other realms of conservation and management and regenerating natural spaces and wildernesses and all of these sorts of things. But to get back to get back to context, I think, if, unless you want to say something else.
No, please.
Yeah, so there are these two main agroecological types, which are grasslands and forests. And a lot of people automatically assume that if we want to adopt syntropic agroforestry, it means that we have to do it at the cost of the forests that already exist. But the reality is that a lot of our agrarian spaces are grassland when they should be forest.
Mm.
So there are wider macro climactic trends which really inform whether it's a forest or a grassland. A big one is temperature. And it's also not just simply temperature. Like if it's obviously it's too cold, when you start dropping below minus 10, minus 20 degrees Celsius, those natural processes, the sugar translocations and the things that make trees vital start to become disrupted. And that's where we move towards an icy tundra, because trees struggle to survive. And obviously if it's getting up above 40 degrees, 50 degrees, some of those processes are also deeply affected. But there is also the variability. So if you're swinging from cold to hot,
right,
consistently, that can really affect the ability for trees to survive.
Okay.
An important one is precipitation. And this is a bit of a nuanced conversation, but in a naturally occurring forest, the rule of thumb is there's a minimal requirement of about 700 mil of rainfall annually.
Okay.
That seems to determine whether the ecosystem is capable of supporting a forest or whether it's capable of supporting a grassland. And we have irrigation, so we have the capacity to fudge those numbers and bring them up to 700.
Yeah.
And realistically as well, the more of that falls in the summer, the more likely it's going to be a forest. Mm. It's not a hard rule, but that's where we generally find a lot of the forests around the world, is where there's a significant amount of rain in the summer, and annually it's about 700 mil a year. Sometimes, like, there's no hard rule, so there's nuance, and sometimes we have things like desert oases, and we have sort of shaded gullies that form in deserts that water runs through, and the precipitation, the low precipitation is collected in an area which provides enough for photosynthesis of trees, and we find these little pockets of forest in unexpected places. And the other confusing element of precipitation is that that's just really tracking rain, whereas condensation and dew and frost are also capable. Snow melt. There are other ways in which water does find its way down into certain ecosystems that can provide adequate amounts of moisture for photosynthesis. There's a famous syntropic forest in New Zealand, which has like a maritime kind of a climate, which is kind of Mediterranean, technically. They get almost all of their rain in the winter. However, the battery of carbon that they have created in their soil, it becomes a water battery that then can facilitate the needs for photosynthesis throughout the dry season in the summer. So there are certain ways in which forests can support themselves. It gets 700 mil or more, but it happens in the winter. But through its own fertility, it can support itself through extenuating circumstances. And interestingly, forests are cloud seeders. They, as they become more complex, there are species of bacteria, there are species of fungi, there are certain compounds which the forest emits, and they become nuclei for precipitation to form and for clouds to form. So an area that is currently less than 700 mils may have the runoff effect of forestation occurrence in the nearby area, which will slowly manipulate and change the rainfall of the ecosystems around it, and will then create the conditions for a forest. And I would say that the forest is the highest expression of terrestrial life on the planet. Nature wants to become a forest, but it's not always capable of doing so. But the more we start reforesting, the more availability for more forest to grow becomes. There's like a runoff effect. And wind. Areas that experience immense amounts of wind, it can become such a detrimental force to the growth of trees. They get pushed over. There's an example that I've seen myself in the south of England, in the, on the White Cliffs of Dover. The wind is so ferocious that the grass can, it can barely grow longer than 5 centimeters, and it's just simply incapable of supporting even woody weeds and herbaceous perennials unless there's a little rock or a little protective force.
Some kind of microclimate kind of a
And there is a need in a lot of farms for windbreaks, because there's windburn is a real thing. Even if you're not farming in a regenerative manner, windbreaks are increasingly becoming adopted, and it is the perfect opportunity to apply syntropic agroforestry in a conventional setting. And the rule of thumb with windbreaks is, for every meter of elevation that the forest, like of height, so if it's 5 meters tall, you get 10 times the amount horizontally along the ground
of like
of wind protection.
Okay.
So if your forest is 20 meters tall, you'll have 200 meters of buffer where the prominence of wind is less severe. But a lot of windbreaks are monoculture, so it only protects in certain areas.
Yeah, sure, you have those gaps between the trees.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, you might slightly slow it down, but you might not as well. And as the trees get taller as well, they provide less of that lower level kind of windbreak.
Exactly. And there is, because syntropic is about biodiversity in many ways, you can create a windbreak which is more protective of wind from the areas that you don't want it, but it's also more productive and biodiverse, and there are different commercial elements that can be introduced obviously a banana is not going to struggle in a, it's going to struggle in a windbreak. Sure. But there are many other species that can be applied in that context.
Yeah.
And really importantly, what determines a forest, we've got the temperature, the wind, and the precipitation as pretty key agents that move the ecosystem towards a forest. A lot of people believe that soil quality is one, and what we're discovering is that it really isn't. And syntropic agroforestry itself, Ernst's farm in Brazil, which, as you mentioned, is one of the most biodiverse blue spots in the world and in Brazil, and there are functionally extinct organisms occurring there. He started with an appalling level of soil degradation. It was pure acidic clay in a tropical context, in a tropical climate. The rain would hit that soil hard and compact it, and it would wash all the nutrients away. He started there in the 70s, and now it's one of the most biodiverse locations in the world. So soil fertility is built by successional organisms moving towards a higher state of complexity, and really any soil context, as long as the other faculties of the climate are adhered to, can be regenerated towards an expression that can support a forest. So it's less important. Obviously, if you have lots of heavy minerals and toxins and things in the soil, that's going to play a role. But in terms of like pure clay or almost pure sand, I don't know if you're aware of the Lightning Ridge Syntropic Project, which is in a really desolate place. It doesn't have the annual precipitation, so they do have to employ irrigation. And they have chosen to work with species of cacti like prickly pear to build that water holding capacity. And they're working with incredibly degraded soils, pretty much arid desert context, and they have been able to build the complexity to support a thriving forest ecosystem. So a lot of people are like, oh no, I live in South Australia in the desert and we have the rainfall, we don't have the wind, we have the adequate temperature range, but my soil is terrible. Yes, that is a challenge, but it's not, it's, you're not incapable of overcoming that challenge. It's
you're very much present. You're not immediately planting the climax forest. You kind of, if you work through the steps, then, you know, in that succession, you're like, yeah, this place definitely could, because you've got those macro trends there.
Yeah, and these macroclimactic factors are influencing the kind of agriculture which is capable. And because agroforestry is not the one and only solution, there's kind of some reprieve there that, oh, I can move into more of a holistic grazing modality and have just as high production and the maximum capacity for complexification. I live in areas that are forested. I happen to love forests, but luckily for me, the areas that I live in are forests, and the highest expression of life is forests. So I am moving in a syntropic agroforestry mindset, and I don't doubt that if I was living in a grassland and I held the same beliefs and structures, then I would be moving more in that direction. And others, I'm not sure of what they are or if they have a name, but there are other practitioners that are sort of working with those macroclimactic trends to create the highest expression of life. And going back to our last conversation, where ecosystems really decline is where the wrong ecotype is forced onto a land which is looking for another expression of complexity. And that's why we're seeing so much degradation. And we have so much arable land on the continent which has been wrongfully identified as a grassland, and that is the perfect place. Like, syntropic agroforestry is designed to repatriate, to reinvigorate the most degraded soils, and many of the more famous syntropic agroforests around the world started at that point with pure clay, and they simply moved through natural succession, and they were able to establish themselves. And once the bedrock, once those foundations were provided, the forests explode, and they're now incredibly biodiverse, beautiful places which are really high expressions of complexity. And the same goes, we said it before, like organisms. Where organisms really decline is where they are forced into a context where they shouldn't be, whether that's chickens in a factory farm or cattle, or whether it's monoculture. Yeah. Whether it's a soybean farm or a corn farm, that is not their ecological niche. Mm. And without those external inputs, they suffer and decline as much as anything else. So that's a way of, you know, establishing ourselves back into a modality of working with the wider context, which is a big challenge, and it involves newness for a lot of farmers. I had a student in my course a couple of weekends ago who's working really hard. She's a passionate regenerative grazer. She's using holistic management. During the course, she had an existential crisis because she realized that she is operating in a woodland and she's been struggling.
Right.
And it was this like, oh my God, what am I doing?
Mm.
Like, this makes sense.
This
like,
is why I've been struggling.
Yeah. So I'm trying to, I'm doing the altruistic thing.
Yeah.
I'm being the good guy. Societally,
yeah,
but
yeah, by the standards of the culture, but yeah, when talking to the land, like, oh wait, I've been ignoring you.
Exactly. And not honoring the organisms that should be there, not honoring them back into their correct ecological niche. And once we have established whether it should be a grassland or a forest, then there's even more conversation to be had about the kind of forest.
Mm.
If you're in a temperate place, you're not growing avocados and mangoes.
Right.
Because that's just outside of the ecological range of those species. If you're in a temperate grassland rather than a tropical savanna, the species that you employ, the kinds of pastures and grasses, the kinds of cattle that you employ, they change, and you kind of need to be fluid. Even though you know that that particular species of cattle is has a higher capacity for regeneration, that is the case when it's in its ecological niche. It has certain gene features, like the color of its skin and the length of its fur, which help it cope in a cold climate or in a hot climate. And even though there are species which are more capable, that capacity kind of ends where its ecological range ends, which is a really challenging element of syntropic agroforestry, because a lot of the information is coming from the tropics. All of the same natural processes, all of the philosophy applies anywhere that can support trees, but the species selection changes and the pace changes, because the growing season in the tropics is 10 months,
right.
And the growing season in a cool temperate climate is 3 months. So obviously over the course of the years, you're going to have a more capable, rapid return in a different context. And the temptation to then try to find those tropical species and bring them back, and that's taking them out of their ecological niche, which leads to degradation and leads to a lapse in the density of the web of relationships. So yeah, context determines the information. It determines the way that it expresses the information.
Thank you for joining us on the Sacred Lab podcast. If you have appreciated this interview, please like, share, comment on whatever platform it is that you're listening or watching this on. See you next time.